So, all right, actually, this before we start, this video suggests a story. The guy in the very beginning who was playing chess in Harvard Square, have many of you seen him? He was there forever, or maybe still there. And I did a story on him many years ago, way before Only a Game, because I was curious about who he was. And he spoke to me when we did the interview. He spoke to me in a very obviously Russian accent. And I thought, well, of course, the guy's a chess master. He's probably Russian. And so at one point, I asked him where he was from. And I can't remember where it was in the United States, but it certainly wasn't Russia. And I said, why do you speak with a Russian accent? And he said, well, people pay a dollar to play chess with me. I figure they're entitled to it. He cheerfully admitted that his accent was completely fraudulent. And that was part of what led me to understand that I was in the right business. Doing stories about people like that has been great fun for many years. We're going to bring the rest of the panel in here, and I will introduce them to you. And then each of them will speak briefly about their books, his or her book. And then my strategy with this sort of arrangement is to get to questions as quickly as possible. So we'll try and do that, and we'll have some fun with it. Thank you all for showing up. I'm going to introduce each person with reference to his book or books. This is Glenn Stout. Glenn is the series editor of Best American Sports Writing. The absolute top of the line edition of it came out about, what, 12 years ago?
14, the year something you co-edited. Like,
that was it.
You guessed it.
Magnificent edition, has two pieces by Charlie Pierce. I think it's the only one with two pieces by Charlie Pierce. Glenn is also the author of this book, Fenway 1912, which is an absolutely magnificent history of the ballpark, the construction, and the early years of guys, Red Sox teams playing there. The Birth of a Ballpark, a Championship and Championship Season, and Fenway's Remarkable First Year. One of the neat things that Glenn has to say about the ballpark in this book is that although people celebrate the fact that Fenway Park is just the way it was in 1912, this is completely wrong. There's almost nothing about Fenway Park now that has anything to do with what Fenway Park was like in 1912, and Glenn's thesis is that that's why it's endured. Anyway, it's a terrific book. We have Tom Whalen here, who has written a book called When the Red Sox Ruled. It's about July and August of this summer. It's not really. It's subtitled Baseball's First Dynasty, and it's about the Red Sox between 1912 and 1918. And that was quite a number of years before they sold Babe Ruth or acquired Josh Beckett. Jane Levy over here is the...
Levy.
Levy, I'm sorry. I got that wrong when we did an interview, too. So Jane Levy is the editor of this year's edition of Best American Sports Writing, which meant that she got to put all her friends in the book. That's pretty much the way it works.
And, I didn't do that. Did I do that?
I don't believe you for a minute. Of course you did. We all do.
Gee, thanks, Bill.
Well, it's good because then people can buy the book and they can find out who the friends of the
editor
are.
Well, we have lots of friends, though. That helps.
And after the book comes out, lots of enemies.
That usually happens, too, yeah.
Jane is also the author of a magnificent biography of Mickey Mantle called The Last Boy. And there are copies of all of these books, including the one that I don't have in my hand, which is The Last Boy. And I will warn you about one thing about The Last Boy, though, and that is... if you grew up idolizing Mickey Mantle, you want to think very carefully before buying The Last Boy. That's all. Is that fair?
No.
Oh. You probably should buy it anyway, but there are some stories about the Mick that, You know, I mean, somebody once, my idol was Willie Mays growing up, and somebody once told me when I had the opportunity to meet him, he said, you know, if you're really lucky, something will come up and he won't make it. So you don't want to meet your idols. Bad things can happen. And so I never did meet Willie Mays in person, but so I can continue to idolize him. It's great. Anyway, I want to give each of these writers an opportunity to speak briefly about the book that they have here today. And then, as I say, open it up as quickly as we can to questions from you, because I know that's why you're here. And so should we start with you?
Sure.
All right.
Thanks, Bill. My close friend and former guest editor.
Yeah. This is just so that next year I'll have something in the book. Because I don't know who the next editor is.
And neither do I yet.
Okay,
so,
that's good. Yeah,
could be anybody. But thanks for everyone coming here. I guess what I'd like to say about Fenway 1912 is, although I love to do this kind of historical research where you get to take a subject that people think they know everything about, and I think we all have been to Fenway Park, and the assumption is we know everything about it, I love going into it and discovering new things. And I think I was able to do that from the start. But there's a reason that I wrote this book that goes beyond the fact that it's an anniversary and that that's the kind of research that I do. But, and that is that Fenway Park is very much the reason that I ended up a writer. When I got out of college, of course, I wanted to write, but I didn't know what I was going to do or anything. And I ended up back in Ohio. I went to school in upstate New York. And I always wanted to live in a city with an old ballpark. Well, the options were somewhat limited back then. I nearly went to Chicago, but at the last minute decided, I don't want more of the Midwest. I want less of the Midwest. So I took a right. And I came to Boston and moved to Boston because of Fenway Park. And I think back how much my life would have been different had it not been for Fenway Park, because for much of the next 10 years, I lived within walking distance of Fenway. And that was a time where you could decide to go to the game at 7:25 and be there at 7:30 and sit with your feet on the seat in front of you and your elbows on the seat behind you out in the bleachers and watch the game like it was in a Barca lounger. And it was those experiences at Fenway Park that, you know, really spawned my interest in Boston baseball history and in Boston history even. I ended up working at the Boston Public Library, where I found out where history lives, but it was all because of Fenway Park. And that's why I came to write this book. And in a funny way, I feel that in writing the book, it's like I'm paying back some sort of debt to that ballpark. Now, I'll tell one other story about Fenway Park, which also involves Bill Littlefield, that isn't in the book for obvious reasons. But
it happened a little bit later than 1912.
A little bit later than 1912. Yeah. But shortly after I came to Boston, I was looking away for a way to combine my interests, which I eventually did by writing about baseball. But early on, I had this notion that I would read baseball poetry outside the Green Monster at Fenway Park, which I did on opening day for like 9 years with a friend of mine. We'd have a little pig-nosed amplifier, and we'd read Casey at the Bat and also contemporary poetry. And I would send out press releases, and suckers from the press would come and interview me. And that's how I met Bill,
right,
who showed up one day with a tape recorder and was like, I have to talk to this crazy guy, because Bill is probably the only other person who was reading baseball poetry in public, which you do on NPR every year. So that's my brief Fenway Park Bill Littlefield story. And that is the reason, though, that I wrote the book, because Fenway Park is a place that changed my life. And I think it's a place that for many people here in New England, it does change your life when you go there. I mean, there are more people, I think, that are fans of Fenway Park than are fans of the Red Sox, particularly this year. And, you know, and Fenway, you know, is transcendent. So that's some of what I try to get to in the book, along with all the history of it. So thank you.
Tom.
Well, I guess I'm what you call a townie. I grew up in this area, and my goal as a young lad was to be a sports writer, and I was. I eventually wrote for the Salem Evening News, graduating from college, and you know, I was incredibly pumped and jacked, as Pete Carroll would say. And I remember, wow, I got my first assignment to cover the Red Sox, 1987. And you know, here are my heroes, you know, Jim Rice, Bob Stanley. And, you know, that euphoria lasted about 5 minutes after the game, when Bob Stanley emerged from the shower with a beer in his hand, with his gut hanging over, saying, gee, I got bombed, but I'm going to be comeback player of the year next year. And that quickly disabused me of sports writing as a profession to follow the rest of my life. So I decided to go into academia because I wanted the long-term view. I felt I love sports and I love politics. And being from Boston, I know a few things about revenge. And it nicely combines in what the topic I decided to write around this time, the Boston Red Sox, the early dynasty years, because all those elements were there. Boston has this incredibly rich history in baseball, but it's not just the 20th century, and I try to get that across in the book. It goes back to the 19th century, when Boston was not only the cradle of liberty, the cradle of baseball. It was to what New York was in the 20th century, in the 19th century, to baseball. And it's funny, I did an earlier book on Bill Russell and the Celtics, and I figured I have to do something on the Red Sox, because this is the yin and yang of sports organizations. You know, the Celtics were pioneers in the field of racial integration. The Red Sox, not so much. And, you know, the success is just so lopsided on either side. But I wanted to get to the roots, well, to the better days. Well, what made Boston special? What made the Red Sox the team in town? Because there was another team in town that was known as the Braves. And they had arguably a more successful run here in Boston than the Red Sox. But why was it, by the early 1950s, it was the Braves that had to leave town? And I think this period, 1912 to 18, explains why the Red Sox has that unique hold that continues to this day.
How many of you are really upset that A-Rod signed with the Yankees now? You think Mickey Mantle would have left the bases loaded twice in a deciding game? In the playoffs or World Series. And by the way, Bill, I tried to put you in the Great American Sports Writing of this year.
Yes, it's a long story, probably better left untold.
Yeah, but I tried.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Yep. The reason I have so few friends left is because I actually took what you said seriously, and I didn't put my friends in. And honestly, it's because most of my friends are too old, but it's all these young guys writing, and gals, of course, writing for all these new fabulous outlets, Sports Literate and Grantland and all these places where sports writing, which is really basically dead in the daily newspaper, is finding a place. And guess what? In cyberspace, they don't cut from the bottom. So people can really write things, sometimes too much, but... you know, I was afraid sports writing was dead, and it's not dead. It's just not tangible anymore. And that gives me actual hope for the future, because the stories about our heroes and the story of Mickey Mantle, my hero, still touches us in places that, you know, very little else does. Does it make any sense? Absolutely not. But it's true. They do. I was in Philadelphia a couple of months ago at a signing, and there's, you know, people like crowd around you. You get this like little tincture of a taste of what it's like to be a Mickey Mantle or a Michael Jordan, and you're in the spotlight and everybody wants your time and attention. So this guy very patiently waited until everybody was done, and he was like this high, which means he was, you know, an inch taller than me. And his name was Vinny from Philly, which means that there were only 500,000 others of Vinny from Philly. But this was Vinny from Philly. And he said to me, I can't do Philly accent too well, but you got behind the legend without destroying the myth. And I said, are you single? Unlike Bill, and unlike many readers who have been very generous and kind and polite in correcting my errors and improving the book edition by edition and adding new stories, I've been absolutely flabbergasted at how much people still love the son of a bitch. I'm talking about people who weren't alive when he played. but who have inherited this "he's my guy" thing from their dads, or maybe on occasion their moms. Mickey Mantle had a very particular hold on the American imagination, and while he had been written about extraordinarily, he himself, I think, has participated in six different autobiographies. none of them really explained to me why he still mattered so much to so many people. Like the teacher I met in Los Angeles, who had gotten hit in the head by what she swore was a Mickey Mantle home run ball in the middle of a game. And in her memory, she was taken in the middle of the game to the Yankee dugout, where Mickey Mantle said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I will be when you sign my ball." And he signed her ball, and she took it home, and it's been this talisman, along with the quarter-inch dent in her skull, and that she would feel, you know, it's kind of like listening to a shell with a C in it. You know, she would rub her little indentation, and she'd be a little girl again at Yankee Stadium getting clobbered on her way back from the concession stand with hot dogs for her brothers. So I hated to point out to her the unfortunate truth that I said, "Nobody signs autographs in the middle of a baseball game. Are you kidding me?" And she said, "Well, I'll check." So she called her brother, who is actually a coach in a Greek basketball league, and comes back to me, you know, predictably chastened, and says, "Well, it was batting practice." But it didn't matter. Still, she had this tangible reminder that put her, as she said to me, and she's a teacher, you know, in touch with greatness. And the number of stories, and I'll take more of them if you got them, that people have told me like that, of his disproportionate hold on emotion, including mine. Now, yeah, did I put some stuff in about his lesser angels? I did. I left the worst stuff out, to be perfectly honest. But, you know, I was not trying to take him down. I was trying to explain why he took himself down, why the self-destructiveness of this man who seemingly had it all, and what it is about him that so many people, and I'm not just talking about New York, I'm talking Philadelphia and Boston and Los Angeles and St. Louis, you know, it's all still Mickey country. And so, yes, he passed out dead drunk in my lap, face down, at 2:30 in the morning in the hotel where my mother lost her virginity.
You should have made him read that. You know, you should have made him buy the book to find that out.
No, yeah, there's more. And no, I didn't have the heart to dump him on the floor among the shards of pretzels and swizzle sticks. But I looked at this man in my lap, and the broken capillaries, and the bloodshot eyes, and the bald spot, and I thought, he's human. And if I want to find out how my hero ended up dead drunk in my lap at 2:30 in the morning in a bar made out to look like it was in the Raj in India, you know, I better go looking all across America. And that's what I did. And I'm still doing it, 600 interviews later.
All right, so this is our opportunity to hear from you, and you have a great trove of baseball knowledge, past and present, and so please take advantage of it. And when you put your hand up, I'll call on you, and yeah, you can address your question to anybody you like.
Yeah, I'd like to address my question to Glenn. Given that you wrote the history of Fenway Park, as well as your wonderful example, and I remember that as well, going to Fenway Park, of sort of being able to go there at any time and getting very good seats. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about some of the changes that have happened to Fenway Park over the years, and does it feel like a different place to you? And maybe elaborate a little bit on that.
It does feel like a different place to me, but that's also, I think, one of the things that makes Fenway Park special, why it's special to so many people. and Bill alluded to it a little bit earlier, is because Fenway didn't stay static. It's always been allowed to change and evolve, and that's, you know, why it remains today. And I think that's also part of the way people connect to it, because the ballpark that I first walked into, and the first time I saw Fenway Park was 1981. I have my unique snapshot picture of that experience. It's different from the experience Carl Yastrzemski had the first time he came to the park, or the first time someone's who's sitting here whose grandfather went to the park the first time. And it's different for the kid who goes to the park the first time now. Because Fenway has changed, each of us has a unique first experience of it. Not like Camden Yards, where it's a beautiful retro park, but it's the same now, basically, as it was 20 years ago. Personally, I find Fenway a little too busy right now. You know, there's signs everywhere. If you go to a game, there's noise everywhere. But I also put that in the context. I understand they have to maximize the money part of it. That's understandable. I wish, for my own nostalgic reasons, that it was still a little quieter, that there was still organ music, that you could still stretch out. That's also not reality. But here's the thing, even with the changes that have taken place in Fenway Park in the last 10 years, where it's gotten much taller, you know, the grandstand is more than twice the height of, that it was originally. It was 42 feet high originally. Now it's nearly 100 feet high to the top of, up above where the sign, Fenway Park sign is. But, you know, 10 years from now, there's going to be more changes to Fenway Park, and the people who see it for the first time are going to have their own unique experience. So in that context, I'm okay with it, but I also think to a degree it's unfortunate that now Fenway more resembles those retro ballparks that were first built in imitation of Fenway Park. Mm-hmm. Fenway is a lot more like Camden Yards now than Camden Yards was like Fenway. So it's kind of flipped over, which I think is interesting and kind of funny.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your great work.
This question is also for Glenn. I think you've been doing the Best American Sports Writing Series for about 20 years now.
21.
What are some of your favorite pieces?
Some of my favorite pieces, there was a terrific piece by Bill Plaschke, who's an LA Times columnist, called Her Blue Haven, which is about a woman who was the ultimate Los Angeles Dodgers fan, and she would write on these message boards on the internet and everything, and he tracked her down and found out that she was disabled, basically living in the desert, and that was her connection to the world. And it's just a wonderfully wrought column that was gorgeous. In the first edition of the book, there was also a story by Bill Knack, the sports writer for Sports Illustrated, called Pure Heart, which was about the horse Secretariat, that I'll never forget, because he begins the story, or very close to the beginning of the story, he talks about the autopsy of Secretariat and how Secretariat's heart was twice the size of that of a normal horse, which was true physiologically, but it was also true emotionally with the connection that people had for that horse. I think about those two stories and a handful of others, and I still get chills because of the emotional impact that they deliver to me, and I think that's why we're all drawn to writing. It's that moment of recognition, those chills that it sends to you. That's what I hope to find in every story. You don't find them in every story, but as Jane can attest, you know, you sometimes find them in a few. And that justifies the reading, all the ones where you don't find them.
So does that mean you like Joe Posnanski? Because I think he does that very well.
I do like Joe. Joe's been in the book a couple of times and will undoubtedly be in it, you know, sometime in the future. You know, everybody can't be in it every year, though. That's the unfortunate part. But, you know, but today, as Jane alluded to also, you can find everybody who's your favorite now all around the country all year long, which certainly wasn't the case 21 years ago.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How are you? I'm curious, when the Walter Payton biography came out, the vitriolic response of some people to, you know, the fact that he wasn't a saint. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your response is to that, you know, that kind of attitude. And secondly, Miss Levy.
Thank you.
Show off.
Did you get any kind of reaction like that when you wrote about about Mickey Mantle?
Stunningly, and you know, I'm opening myself up to trouble here, no. What I've been astonished and, you know, touched by is the number of people who say, now we understand. We didn't really want to think about it, maybe, but now we understand what produced the behavior that was, you know, that caused him to self-destruct. I mean, that's a biographer's job, is to, you know, and sometimes in sports writing, to explain guys to themselves because they don't understand themselves. You know, Mantle was sexually abused as a young boy, first by his half-older sister, which is something that his wife, Merlin, disclosed in a family memoir in 1995. It didn't get a lot of attention back then. And she, you know, it's all one paragraph. I wasn't sure I should bring this up, and I know people won't want to hear this, but when he told me about this, it was the first time in 42 years that I felt I really understood my husband. So I spoke to her about it. She passed away a couple of years ago. I talked to her before that. And, you know, she elaborated. And so then I went and searched to see whether other people in his life had known about this, because he had never spoken to her about it, you know, before. He never spoken about it again. In fact, a lot of friends, male friends, he had confided in a couple of female friends. And he wasn't just molested by his half-older sister, also by some bully boys in the neighborhood, and then by a high school English teacher. Now, you know, in half of America, guys are going to wave a flag and say, oh, Mrs. Robinson, isn't that lucky? Well, the fact of the matter is that if somebody uses their age or authority to extort sexual favors, it's abuse. And so knowing about these three instances, I then went and talked to psychologists who treat survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And what they see, nobody's going to be able to diagnose Mickey Mantle from the grave. It wouldn't be proper or ethical. But what they did tell me was the constellation of symptoms that they see in these kids. Rampant promiscuity, almost, you know, indiscriminate sexuality, drinking and drug abuse, bedwetting. Mickey Mantle went on the Dick Cavett Show and announced he was a bedwetter. An inability to get close to people, distrust, and sometimes people lead actually two different lives. You know, by the end of his life, he had one life in Georgia with his girlfriend, and one life in Dallas, even though he never divorced his wife, because she, as he said, all she ever wanted to be was Mrs. Mickey Mantle. You know, and he still had a home in Dallas, and when he was mortally ill, it's back to Dallas that he went. And it was like, you know, those little things you have when you're a kid, like kaleidoscope, and you turn it, and suddenly all the jumbled pieces make sense, and you see, you know, a pattern. That's what that was like for me. And so do I think everybody wanted to read about this? You know, some people probably squeamish and, you know, put down the book. But to me, you know, now I understand this guy and I can empathize with this guy. And how hard must it have been in the Yankee locker room? You think that's something you were going to joke about in the shower with Moose Scarron and Cleve Boyer? I don't think so. I haven't gotten those kinds of comments, and I'm really grateful that I haven't.
Lastly, do you think that Mickey ever really realized his emotional hold on the sporting public?
Only at the very end. You know,
very end when he was playing, or very end of his life?
Very end of his life. I mean, one of the things that the psychologist, self-loathing, right? I must have done something wrong. I must be terrible, you know, for people to have abused me in this way. And he couldn't believe that anybody loved him. He couldn't believe his wife loved him. He couldn't believe his girlfriend loved him. And certainly not all the rest of us. He just couldn't see himself as worthy of being loved. And at the very end, after he had the liver transplant, no, it was not fixed. He did not jump the queue. And after they discovered, while he was on the table, they had taken out his liver, which was hard, like a doorstop. And twice the size it should have been. like Secretariat's heart. You know, they've got the guy on the table, and the pathologist comes back and says, do you guys have any idea what's going on in there? And he had a form of cancer that is so voracious. There, you know, the doctor doing the transplant basically knew there was no hope. Well, what do? Let Mickey Mantle bleed out on the table? That wouldn't be ethical either. So they transplanted the liver into him. Within 2 weeks, the chemotherapy he had started, it was apparent it was going to do no good. But then he had that press conference from Baylor where he said, you know, don't be like me. Pointed at himself, don't be like me. He, of course, also took a sample of his own feces and mailed it to Barry Helper, the collector of Yankee memorabilia. And I think that was the other part of Mickey, you know, sort of like, it was sort of like, this is what I think of all of your collecting and your memorabilia hunting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are all, to a certain extent, sports writers as well as sports journalists. And in this era of sort of 24-hour cycles for sports, the same way we have 24-hour cycles for news, love you to just comment and maybe even Bill weigh in a little bit on where you think we are right now with sports journalism and how it's changed. This in a somewhat incredible week here where we had a pretty landmark investigative piece on the front page of the Boston Globe by Bob Poehler on Wednesday, I think it was, that exposed a lot of the troubles that was going on that were going on in the Red Sox clubhouse. I don't want to go there, but you know, it was sort of came back as a week where there, that was a truly sort of classic investigative journalism piece about sports on the front page of the Globe, sort of thing we don't really see that much anymore in journalism today, at least as far as sports goes. So love you to, you know, maybe a couple of comments.
Anybody
on that.
Particular?
No, anyone okay. Who wants to jump in. Thanks.
Well, I mean, you know, the publishers always want folks like us to now do Twitter things, and I adamantly refuse to believe that there is anything worth saying in 140 characters. That is antithetical to the way I lead my life and make my living. So I won't do it. And yes, the things are getting more and more and more reduced. And newspapers do not have the money to fund the kind of reporting that we used to do. I don't mean just, you know, my friend Michelle Kaufman at Miami Herald can't go to Wimbledon. Or, you know, the U.S. Open, okay, so they'll take wire service coverage. But what do you think the chances are that the San Francisco papers would have let those two guys report on steroids and nothing else for as long as it took to document that? Why is it that when I suggested as a book to my publisher, taking the four women who have taken on the NFL on behalf of their dead, dying, and demented husbands, you know, literally sometimes carrying their brains here to Braintree so that their deaths will not have been a complete waste. You know, the answer is, well, you know, that's too depressing. People don't want to read about that anymore. So it's not just the funding of the research. It's the sense that everything, it's market driven. It, you know, everybody says nobody wants to read that, so perforce nobody can read that because nobody lets you write it. And it's scary to me.
I think that in response to the same question, I mean, there certainly is a financial problem, as there is in many areas. But I think there is still some right. I mean, the NFL is a good example. For years and years and years, the National Football League adamantly denied that there was any connection between getting hit in the head a whole bunch of times and being and losing your mind by the time you were 55 years old, not being able to remember the names of your children. It was, to some extent, a result of people banging away at that subject and not letting it, and finding the wives and children of the men who'd been so badly damaged and interviewing them.
It's one paper, though. It's the, you know. It's
well, the but there have been stories, there have been documentaries and TV stuff and radio stuff, too, that finally forced and embarrassed the National Football League into acknowledging that the doctors that were in their employ were basically employed to cover up on behalf of the NFL rather than to do real medicine and real research. So it has, I think there has been some recognition of that. That having been said, I mean, obviously all newspapers have been shrinking and sports sections along with them, and it's an awfully good thing that there are other, as you mentioned, outlets for writers to take advantage of.
And the writers are endlessly inventive too, which is if there's a savior in the process, it's the writers themselves, who, despite everything conspiring against good reporting and great writing, manage to overcome that time and time again.
But I guess what I would say is what bothers me, I'm a political historian by trade. Structurally, there's huge conflicts of interest here in the whole journalism, sports journalism industry. I mean, you look on television or the newspapers, you have these sports writers, they do the sport talk shows, and they're on these programs that, for example, the New England Patriots sponsor, and they cover the Patriots at the same time, and it happens with the Red Sox and the Bruins. I mean, that seems to me like pretty unethical to do, you know, play both sides against the middle here. And it bothers me that you can't, there's so many crossovers now due to the mediums, you know, that you can't differentiate between, well, whose agenda is this writer, is he, you know, supporting, like Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe. Everyone in town knows he's Larry Lucchino's mouthpiece. I mean, that's a given. But I mean, they play these games, you know, a favorite sports writer for this person or this team, and I don't know, to me it's depressing.
He didn't return his calls all last night.
That's true. That's true. But I think this brings down overall the profession. I agree, though, this individual sports writing, the pieces are brilliant. And, for example, ESPN does a lot of great stuff in Grantland and so forth. But ESPN, do you see a lot about, you know, the gentleman in Miami or the Heat? You see a lot of negative reporting about that team? Gee, I wonder why. And, you know, that's what bothers me about the profession. That's what got me out of the profession. When the paper I was on, I was given a standing order. It was Salem, Massachusetts. Anyone from Salem here? Yes. You know, the sports editor at the time told me, we can't do any negative stories on Mark Bavaro, who was a local resident. Who was it? There was John Tudor from Peabody, the Cy Young winner for the St. Louis Cardinals, and someone else, Robbie Carpenter of the Washington Capitals, because they're all local boys, and they won't return our calls if we report what's really going on in their lives or, you know, they punched someone out at the local 7-Eleven, you know, while they were drunk. So, you know, and that frankly got me out of the profession. I just thought it was untruthful. I just thought it was a charade.
That's it. I think we're going to just have one more question, and then you all have to go learn about somebody else's books. So before you do that, of course, you'll want to buy the ones out here. And the authors will be sitting at this table, and they'll happily sign Your Best Pal. Glenn, Jane, Tom. Go ahead.
Okay, you're all good analysts, not only of baseball, but of the culture. So I want to ask you a question about fandom in the context, about fans, in the context of the stories that have already been alluded to in the Boston Globe here, and all this bad press, front page every day about our local Red Sox in a baseball-obsessed town. And my question is, do you think this is just one of those stories that will, you know, be hot for a while and pass? Or is there something about this that could have a lasting effect that could diminish fans' interest, not only in the Red Sox, but maybe could have some reverberations in other cities around the country? That's my question.
You mean that the same story that we're
well, in terms of the revelations about the Red Sox and drinking in the clubhouse and all that kind of stuff.
Shocking. Baseball yeah. players drink. Yeah.
All
oh, my
the
God.
Time.
Not only that, oh, wow. they eat fast food as well.
Oh, yeah.
And people,
and they do it when they're naked.
Unbelievable. And while they're playing video games.
While they're playing video
but,
games.
But remember the naivete of fans and the fans that, well, that are going to that park.
Well, I mean, I was doing my book, you know, the Red Sox clubhouse of the dynasty era, it was just completely divisive, along sectarian lines. The Catholics hated the Protestants. Terce Speaker, arguably the greatest player in Red Sox history, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And Babe Ruth had his bats sawed in half. And Babe Ruth and Smokey Joe Wood, who was an absolute racist, white supremacist, they almost came to blows. I mean, the manager was this Irish Catholic guy from Lewiston, Maine, Bill Carrigan. And he had a fight, Terce Speaker, for control of that team. Well, maybe that's what the next manager needs to have, good boxing skills to get Lackey and company in the locker room. But and that hasn't changed.
And the thing is, you know, everybody is in a tizzy. I was talking earlier, you know, there was talk after the Bruins won that, well, you know, Boston really is a hockey town. You know? And, you know, since this thing happened with the Red Sox, it's like, where are the Patriots? Where are the Bruins? You can't even see them. And you know what? People are upset and in a tizzy because they love them. You don't get upset about stuff you don't like or indifferent to. And I think it's a measure of what addicts people are in this town, that they're so upset about what's happening.
And if I could add to that, it's just like, I never thought in my lifetime I'd hear, why can't the Red Sox be more like the Bruins? I mean, it's really amazing.
Hey, Bill, there was a gentleman over here. Can we take his call, his question?
Sure.
Sure. Hello.
It could, and I think to a degree that's what you see in Chicago with Wrigley Field, where people are so happy to be in Wrigley Field, and I love Wrigley Field. It's a great place to go and see a baseball game. The physical experience of being in Wrigley Field is more pleasant than the physical experience in Fenway because you're not eating your knees, you know. but they haven't allowed that to happen here yet. Now, there's no question that right now, I mean, they're on this incredibly long streak of sellouts at Fenway Park, that Fenway Park is as much of a selling point as the team, and they could survive a downturn on the field and still sell out for a long, long time because you got people coming from all over the country who really don't care about the Red Sox, who just want to see Fenway and see a game in Fenway. It could happen. It hasn't happened. And for Red Sox fans, let's hope it doesn't, because you don't want to be the Cubs fans. I mean, God love them. You don't want to be a Cubs fan.
But I think another thing to remember here is the playoff format's changed since the 90s. If they didn't have the wild card, do you think there'd be the same kind of fervor for the Red Sox in Fenway Park right now? I don't think so. And now they're going to add another wild card team. So, I mean, how much harder are the Red Sox? I mean, they can just... This year, they would obviously have made that other wild card. I mean, they wouldn't have to do much given their payroll to get into the playoffs.
Yeah. I just want to say Wrigley Field is not the reason that the Cubs haven't won in 103 years.
Right.
Not the goat or the cat either.
The goat, not the goat. Thank you all for showing up. Appreciate it.